The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. It's great to be with you. It's a cool, drizzly day here in the UK, or at least here in the Midlands. But we're certainly cozy inside of our studio here in the beautiful Edstone facility. And coming an hour earlier, hopefully our listeners in the UK and Europe have caught on to that. We're an hour earlier just for this week. Waiting for President Trump and Boris Johnson to bring both of our countries into alignment, finally, with respect to daylight savings time. We'll see. Well, last night, Amy Coney Barrett was confirmed by the Senate, 52-48. I think just one Republican voted against the confirmation. And with everything else, I think it was pretty much along party lines. So that now gives President Trump a comfortable majority in the Supreme Court, I guess a 6-3 majority or a 5-4, depending upon how you feel about John Roberts. In any event, I'll just remind you what my father wrote back in January of 2019. This was in the Trumpet. He said, I believe this prophetic account in Amos 7 implies that there's a conservative advantage in the Supreme Court, one that favors the Jeroboam administration. He said, radicals want to control the courts, and this is why they're constantly talking about packing it, you know, adding more justices now. And of course, Joe, that's not popular, by the way, and so Joe Biden's doing everything he can not to say that, but everyone else in the Democrat Party certainly is. He says, radicals want to control the courts, especially the Supreme Court, and God upset those plans. He has a plan of his own. So you can go back and look at, well, as I've noted before, the death of Justice Scalia back in the early part of 2016, I believe, and President Obama, he had 11 months to nominate a successor. He just didn't have the majority in the Senate. And so Merrick Garland never did go through. And then following that, of course, the radical left, for them, it was supposed to be Hillary Clinton, just a continuation of the Obama administration. Think about how different the Supreme Court would look right now had Hillary Clinton won in 2016. President Trump has nominated and they've been confirmed. Three Supreme Court justices. I don't even know what president it was that last appointed three of them. Sam was saying the last, I guess since Reagan, it's just been two. That's the most for all of the presidents since Reagan. And here's Donald Trump, and he's not even finished with 4 years yet. This is just one term. And he's totally reshaped the court. And of course, the left, the radical left, the Democrat media complex, well, they're just infuriated at what has happened. And it's happened in a way that, well, it's been fast and relatively smooth, particularly when you compare it to Justice Kavanaugh a couple of years ago. Here's how Senator Ed Markey responded to ACB's confirmation. He's a Democrat from, I believe, Massachusetts. Clip 4.
Originalism is racist. Originalism is sexist. Originalism is homophobic. For originalists like Judge Barrett, LGBT stands for let's go back in time, a time when you couldn't marry who you love, when you couldn't serve in the military if you were trans, a time when rights were not extended to gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender, queer, questioning, or intersex individuals. Originalism is just a fancy word for discrimination.
And so they're protesting loudly. Chuck Schumer says it's one of the darkest days in Senate history. This is taking us back to the Stone Age. Originalism is racist. A lot of people agree with that statement right there. You want to go back to the founding fathers or the founding documents? You want to rule according to the Constitution? What a racist you are. You're discriminatory. It shows just how far removed we are, or at least a lot of people in our nations, how far removed we are from those founding institutions, from that bedrock foundation. Yesterday, I referred to that speech by Alexander Solzhenitsyn back in 1978, the most condemning speech ever given on American soil. That's what my father said about that speech that he gave at Harvard University in 1978. And my father's emphasized this speech repeatedly. And he warned back in 1998, my father did, the West scorned his message. That negative reaction is proving to be a major disaster. They scorned the message. They scorned the speech. A world split apart. That was the title of Solzhenitsyn's speech. We featured it on the 1998 Trumpet, the cover, underneath the headline, Fulfilled Prophecy from a Nobel Prize Winner. Solzhenitsyn's warning has undeniable ties to Bible principles and Bible prophecy. Yesterday, I mentioned this article from Quillette. This author, Sergey Klanerman, who, like Solzhenitsyn, he was a refugee from the communist days. And Klanerman writes this, rereading Solzhenitsyn's speech today, in the fall of the horrible year 2020, I feel it truly prophetic. I feel like the speech is prophetic, this speech from 1978. It is now painfully clear, he wrote, as Solzhenitsyn was able to discern 42 years ago, the West has been gradually losing the will and intellectual ability to defend itself, not so much against foreign armies, as it may have appeared in 1978, but against an army of internal critics determined to demolish everything the West used to stand for. As I said yesterday, sickness from within. Here's a commentator today with this posting talking about this truly prophetic speech. Klanerman can see what's happening to our nations. And Solzhenitsyn could see it back in 1978. And all of you listeners know that, of course, the Bible prophesied of this sickness within, Isaiah 3, sickness from head to toe, from the top of our heads all the way down to our toes. The United States, and Britain too for that matter, we need this speech now more than ever. We need to heed the warning of this speech. We need to learn a little bit about this prophet, you could say, a truly prophetic speech. Solzhenitsyn, he died in 2008, by the way, born in 1918, so he lived a long life all through most of the 20th century. It's a name that, well, many young people probably aren't familiar with, but it's one that you should become familiar with. He fought for Soviet Russia in World War II. He witnessed the Soviets committing war crimes. He was later arrested for criticizing the Soviet communist system and criticizing Stalin. And he was sentenced to 8 years in forced labor camps. And then he was sentenced to exile for life within the Soviet Union. And then you fast forward to the mid-1970s, and that's when he, you know, they were starting to make some reforms in the USSR, and he was a prolific writer, and the Russian regime didn't like, or the Soviet regime didn't like what he was writing, so he lost his citizenship back in the mid-1970s. And then he gave that blistering speech at Harvard in 1978. And throughout his life, as I say, he wrote poems and novels and other writings, a prolific writer, and he exposed what was happening inside the Soviet Union. He told us a lot about the communist mind, the Russian character, and even a lot of commentators acknowledged that he wrote the truth. He spoke the truth. He dedicated his life to opposing the communist Soviet Union. He dedicated his life to exposing its atrocities. My father wrote that many people think he did more to bring down that system than any other Russian. Never has such a massively murderous government as the Soviet Union been so deeply exposed by one man. Exposed by one man. He has lots of famous writings, the Gulag Archipelago. I think in 1970 he was awarded the Nobel Prize for Literature for this particular book. But the thing of it is, if you go to that Harvard speech, Solzhenitsyn wasn't just exposing the Soviets or Russians. He was exposing evil itself. And that's why my father drew so much attention to it. As my father wrote in 1998, Solzhenitsyn also exposed America and Britain. And we have rejected almost 100% of his criticism. That should have made us do some serious thinking about being biased, but it didn't. His Harvard speech sent shockwaves through the West. Most of the media turned bitterly against him. This is a chapter in our history that we desperately need to understand. We need to understand this history. We need to go back and revisit this speech, this truly prophetic warning. Americans and the rest of the world, the West in particular, they heard the message about the Soviet Union. A lot of them even applauded it. But we didn't so much like the message that was directed at us, at our nations. And here we are 42 years later, and at least with respect to one commentator, he's speaking up and saying Solzhenitsyn was right. It was truly prophetic. Both my father's article from 1998 and this recent piece from Quillette, it highlighted this core of the Harvard commencement speech. Solzhenitsyn said, "A decline in courage may be the most striking feature which an outside observer notices in the West in our days." He's saying this in 1978. "The Western world has lost its civil courage, both as a whole and separately. In each country, each government, each political party, and of course in the United Nations, such a decline in courage is particularly noticeable among the ruling groups and the intellectual elite, causing an impression of loss of courage by the entire society." He says further on, "Political and intellectual functionaries base state policies on weakness and cowardice, and the decline in courage at times, attaining what could be termed a lack of manhood, means they get tongue-tied and paralyzed when they deal with powerful governments and threatening forces, with aggressors and international terrorists." He says, finally, "Must one point out that from ancient times a decline in courage has been considered the first symptom of the end?" Did we receive this warning back in 1978? Look at how chillingly true this is in 2020. My father said, "He is discussing the death of our nations. But that's only a small part of the problem. History also thunders that he's right. So does Bible prophecy." I mean, just look at our nations today. Our nations have lost their courage. I should have brought some of the stats with me. I had it in a previous lecture I was working on. Just all of the sickness and the disease that our founding fathers had in their midst, in Philadelphia in particular, during those hot summer months. And here are the founding fathers. They were coming into the city to do work for the nation, to lay the groundwork for the fledgling nation of the United States, risking their lives. Today, I suppose, well, they'd all be hunkering down. Fearing what might spread from one person to the next. Look at the cowardice of our government policies today, so many of them. And again, there's a few exceptions. As I've said before, Donald Trump has certainly shown himself to be somewhat courageous. He's made some bold moves, even this year, taking out Soleimani and other things. And, of course, what he's doing more recently with respect to the virus. But just looking at it, stepping back from that administration for a moment, and just looking at our society as a whole, and leaders that say, here's the proper response. Lock everything down. You stay in your homes. I saw an article today praising the way they've handled this down in Victoria in southern Australia. And of course, what they've done there, it's frightening. It should be. But our people are so duped. They're so afraid. They're so scared. And the media, so full of propaganda and lies, as I said yesterday. There they are, just praising these left-wing authoritarians. Clamp it down. Deny people their rights. This is now how we deal with the flu. A flu that's life-threatening for the elderly and for the sick and infirmed. But that pretty much is just a mild virus for everyone else. A relatively mild virus. That's what we now know. What's the average age of COVID-related deaths? I think it's 77. And then you just compare it to the average age of deaths, period. It's about the same. Of course it's a virus. Of course it's a sickness. But how did they confront this sort of threat 200-300 years ago? Well, I'm sure the founding fathers were practicing common sense measures. But to suspend civil liberties? There's all the headlines, even in the last week or two, like this one. The third wave of COVID-19 in the U.S. is officially worse than the first two. Boy, it's worse than even back in March, we're now told. And of course, they're lying. They're lying. And President Trump's out there, to his credit, saying, look, the reason there's more cases is because we have so many more tests now than we did in March. And yet, so there's the third wave, and yet fewer people are dying. Fewer people are going to hospitals. Never mind any of that. Just focus on the headline. This is a third wave, and this one is worse than number one and number two. That's all you need to know. Well, what about lower hospitalizations or lower deaths? Never mind. What about the fact that young people, they don't die from this? Never mind. They could carry it. They could carry it. They could spread it. They've got to stay home from school. This is even from the New York Times. This is just a few days ago. The New York Times, of all publications, has come out and acknowledged the obvious with respect to young people. It says here, researchers once feared that school reopenings might spread the virus through communities, but so far there is little evidence that it's happening. Now, we feared that it would spread from young person to young person. So that's why we've got to cancel school, but there's no research to support it. There's no evidence. Got to follow the science, right? It says months into the school year, School reopenings across the U.S. remain a patchwork of plans, in-person, remote, and hybrid, masked and not, socially distanced and not. But amid this jumble, one clear pattern is emerging. Here's the New York Times. Now, pay attention. So far, schools do not seem to be stoking community transmission of the coronavirus. According to data emerging from random testing in the U.S. and Britain, elementary schools especially seem to see remarkably few infections. These are children presumably playing with each other on the playground. And yet remarkably few infections. Here's the New York Times finally bringing to its readers the information that really it was there months ago. And yet, even though it's in the New York Times, is that what's featured on the evening news? It's like the president tweeted yesterday, COVID, COVID, COVID. That's the whole storyline. Well, they confirmed, she gave her oath last night, Amy Coney Barrett. Nobody was wearing a mask, says CNN. That's what this whole election hinges on, as far as the radical left-wing media is concerned. Over at the New York Post, Carol Markowitz, she writes this: last week, some fantastic news from the science world should have given full-time schooling advocates real hope. Instead, officials are signaling that we may never return to full in-person learning, at least not like pre-COVID. I mean, this may be a change for good. We may never go back to school. At least not like we did before COVID. Never mind the science. As she writes, alas, the science doesn't matter. We left it behind long ago. Instead, we're seeing signs that schools may not open for full-time learning for years. For years! Think of the message this sends to our children. Cowardice. Fear-mongering. You wonder how much of this will change, though, on November 4th, at least in the United States. I guess we'll see. But here's Governor Andrew Cuomo of New York bragging about how his state handled the virus. And, of course, his state was the absolute worst by a long shot. I mean, just far out in front of every other state as far as deaths are concerned. But here he is on the news yesterday, clip one.
You can control the spread of the virus. Other countries have done it. New York has done it. We were told we were going to have 140,000 people in our hospitals. We only had 18,000 because you can flatten the curve.
Well, he certainly kept those hospital beds free by sending them all into the nursing homes instead. We flattened the curve. Just in that statement alone, he basically admitted that it wasn't as bad as we thought it would be in March. And yet here come the headlines. The third wave is the worst of all. It's the worst of all. You know what this governor also says about schools? He said the schools are important because you will very often see the schools be a place of transmission. It's just an outright lie. It's not following the science. It's not even following the New York Times from just a few days ago, October 22nd, I think it is. Markowitz at the Post says schools are not major sources of COVID spread. And yet we have got to submit to the authoritarianism of this state governor, who presided over the most COVID deaths by far in the United States. You've got to submit to his lead. You've got to do the same with the premier down in Victoria. This is just leadership. This is the leaders of today. How do we confront this test, this trial? Well, you cower in fear, basically. There was a Danish mask study. Just the News pointed this out, how that these experts looked at, I think they tested 6,000 people, 3,000 that were wearing masks and 3,000 that didn't. And it says here, in spite of their now ubiquitous presence in most of the Western world today, relatively little evidence exists to support widespread use of face masking to prevent the spread of respiratory disease. It says here, a 2019 World Health Organization review, this is 2019, the WHO of the UN, a review of the pandemic or review of pandemic mitigation measures, for instance, found no evidence that face coverings helped to stop the spread of influenza. No evidence. And that's what this Danish mask study turned up. And so naturally, it's ignored by all of the health journals. It's ignored by the media. If it doesn't fit with what Dr. Fauci says, well, then just don't. It doesn't even fit into the frame, like I said yesterday. Here's what Dr. Fauci said a couple days ago, clip two.
If people are not wearing masks, then maybe we should be mandating it.
Now, he said back in March that they don't do any good. So even he's flip-flop back and forth. And yet you listen to them, the ones insisting that this is the way to stop it. This is the way to prevent the spread. I mean, they speak as if it is on final authority backed by a ton of evidence. And in fact, there's no evidence. Here's Joe Biden from a couple days ago as well, clip three.
First, I'll go to every governor, urge them to mandate mask wearing in their states. And if they refuse, I'll go to the mayors and county executives and get local masking requirements in place nationwide. Because masks save lives, period.
Period. They actually don't. They don't stop the spread, or at least there's not evidence proving that it does. But the bottom line is, look, you just do what we tell you to do. Everybody should be fearing for their lives right now. There was a story in the Daily Mail, by the way, about influenza. And it said here, it was feared by many to be the perfect winter storm, a nightmare situation that would push our health service over the edge. The twendemic of flu, which kills about 10,000 Britons every year, 10,000 Britons a year, just for the ordinary flu. And a second deadly wave of COVID-19. So if you get the flu and then COVID-19, well, you talk about a third wave, we might as well start talking about a fourth wave. The Daily Mail says there's just one curious problem. Flu, it seems, has all but vanished. Well, you hardly have any cases of the flu right now. In the midst of this spike of COVID-19. What are the reasons? Well, I guess the Daily Mail wants to think that it's social distancing and whatnot that's slowing that down. I guess you can draw your own conclusions. In any event, look at the bad government. Look at the policies of our governments today. Look at the cowardice in so many of our government policies to force people into their homes, to deny them their rights, and all to deal with a virus. What happens when the real dangerous viruses come, as the Bible prophesies? It just highlights the desperate need for new government, as the new trumpet says. It's right on the cover. New government is coming, and does this world ever need it? As I say, you look at not just the domestic policies, but abroad as well. And more often than not, you have, like Solzhenitsyn said in 1978, you have so many of the Western nations dealing with tyrants, dealing with communist regimes in a timid and fearful and ineffectual manner, thinking that that's the way to solve world problems. As I said earlier, there's a few exceptions to this, of course. You have President Trump, as I say, striking out at terrorism the way that he did in January and encouraging people to get on with their lives. But timidity and fear, they're so widespread in the West that we just consider it to be normal. In some cases, In some cases, commentators see it as sophisticated to be timid and weak. And of course, we as Christians, we've got to be especially careful that this way of the world doesn't rub off on us, because God says we have to be soldiers. God says we have to embrace hardness. God says we need to be courageous. Speaking about what message government today sends to our children, well, we in God's church, as parents, as God-fearing parents, the message we want to get through to our children is that they need to grow up and courageously make a stand for God and to obey God's laws, even in an age where the spirit of lawlessness is so strong. My father made this comment in Malachi's message. It's one I've given to you before about courage, spiritual courage. He said in the Laodicean churches, spiritual courage may be the greatest need. Without it, the other virtues are of little value. God's people can't cower in fear and still grow in God's love. Think about that statement. God's people cannot cower in fear. We've got to be out there growing in love. He quotes Proverbs 28 and verse 1 that says the righteous are as bold as a lion. Now, this is true on a personal level. It's true on a national level. In that article in 1998 on Solzhenitsyn, my father highlighted Leviticus 26, verses 18 and 19. It says this, "And if you will not yet for all this hearken unto me, then I will punish you seven times more for your sins, and I will break the pride of your power." And then my father said, "That is exactly the way Alexander Solzhenitsyn and others have described Britain and especially America today. Our nations, the will is broken, and you can see it if you look at foreign policy, if you look at health policy. You can see it at every level of government. You can see it at every level of society. You can see it in how the local authorities deal with the anarchists that are destroying cities, that are looting businesses, killing people in the streets, attacking law enforcement, attacking police. You had more rioting last night in Philadelphia. Yet another shooting incident. Someone that wouldn't drop a knife, and so the police shoot him. And immediately, an uprising in the city. Mass looting and rioting. Well, as you know from a few weeks ago, the radical left, the ones that are, you know, speaking in front of the cameras, they were calling for this to be tamped down. Finally! Because they knew it wasn't polling well for the Democrats. All summer long, though, they were inciting violence. Violence and burning, murder. And we saw it happen in city after city after city. And as we've noted on this program, in so many of these places, it's what, 200, 300, 400 anarchists? And in some cases, there was a scene last night in Philadelphia where you had the law enforcement running away. Who can forget that image from here in the UK? All the policemen running from the so-called protesters, mostly peaceful. When the police are on the run, where is the courage to stand up to this? There's a few exceptions, as I say. But whether it's on the local level or the state level, the president says he'll come right in there and settle these things down in a second if the governors would just invite him in. But here's all of this violence and looting. You're not going to see commentators today saying, "Oh no, this is going to be a super spreader of COVID." If it's rioting, it's okay. COVID takes a day off if there's a riot going on. This is the nonsense you hear on a nightly basis. That passes for cable news. Where is the courage? We don't see it in society, so we have to make sure that we get this lesson individually Do you individually have the courage to stand up to evil? To stand up to evil? To stand up to it even when it's dwelling inside your mind? Can you make a stand for God? Can we make a stand even like Solzhenitsyn did? Or like Herbert Armstrong did? Or like my father did back in 1989 and 1990? To stand against all of this Laodicean delusion, the lies, the deception. It says here, I think this is from Solzhenitsyn's speech. He said, and yet in early democracies, he's talking about our drift away from God. I mean, that's the founding. That's the founder that we want to stay locked into. It says, and yet in our early democracies, as in American democracy at the time of its birth, all individual human rights were granted on the grounds that man is God's creature. That is, freedom was given to the individual conditionally in the assumption of his constant religious responsibility. 200 or even 50 years ago, this is Solzhenitsyn in 1978, he says 200 or even 50 years ago, it would have seemed quite impossible in America that an individual be granted boundless freedom with no purpose, simply for the satisfaction of his whims. Those people on the streets of Philadelphia, they think they have freedom. Wow, we can smash in this window and rob the store. Total freedom. Where does that lead? He said, the West has finally achieved the rights of man and even excess, but man's sense of responsibility to God and society has grown dimmer and dimmer. All the celebrated technological achievements of progress, including the conquest of outer space, do not redeem the 20th century's moral poverty, which no one could have imagined, even as late as the 19th century. Who could have imagined this? Who could have imagined this kind of moral poverty? Who could have imagined the kind of statement that that senator from Massachusetts made on the Senate floor just last night? About the confirmation hearing of Amy Coney Barrett. How much, if that was 1978, how much more have we forgotten God here in the early part of the 21st century? Now, if someone's nominated for the Supreme Court, leftists, as you heard at the top of the show, will portray her as a rabid radical. Because she believes in God. Because she believes in originalism. You think they would have reacted that way in the 18th century? Or the 19th century? In the 18th century, it would have been unthinkable to our founding fathers that someone would be put on the Supreme Court who didn't believe in God, who didn't intend to rely on the Constitution as the supreme law of the land. But here we are today, no trust in God, complete trust in man, complete trust in human reasoning. Jeremiah said, cursed be the man that trusts in man and makes flesh his arm or his strength, and whose heart departs from the eternal. My father said in his 1998 piece, because we have placed our trust in man, we are under a dreadful curse. The evidence is all around us. It's all around us. My father went on to say, Mr. Solzhenitsyn questioned our manhood, and he was correct to do so. Women rule our families. Our boys lack strong masculine role models. Our society is becoming more effeminate and female dominated. Even in 1 Corinthians 6, you can see what Paul says about all of this evil behavior that won't be in God's kingdom, that's for sure. And he even says effeminate. Then read Isaiah 3, the first couple of verses. And see God, see where it's prophesied
God said he would take away real leaders, real men. And then read the rest of the chapter. I'm talking about Isaiah 3, upside down families. Herbert Armstrong said that families are the building block of society, the building block of the nation. And yet look at our nations today, look at our families today, and you can see why our nations are in the condition that they are in. Families are breaking apart. Parents don't discipline their children. They don't confront evil, the evil in human nature. It's like I said in the program last Friday, if you don't confront it, then it will spread. It will spread like leaven. It spreads like disease. That's the disease we should be concerned about. The spread of all the evil and filth that we see throughout society with respect to the family. Parents divorce, and then they divorce again multiple times. Society tells us that families don't matter. A family can be whatever you want it to be. The message coming through loud and clear is just indulge in what you individually find fulfilling and gratifying. Just indulge in it. If it feels good, do it. Everything will be fine. Solzhenitsyn said this: the defense of individual rights has reached such extremes as to make society as a whole defenseless against certain individuals. He said this tilt of freedom toward evil has come about gradually, but it evidently stems from a humanistic and benevolent concept according to which man, the master of the world, does not bear any evil within himself, and all the defects of life are caused by misguided social systems, which must therefore be corrected. It says here, voluntary self-restraint is almost unheard of. Everybody strives toward further expansion to the extreme limit of the legal frames. It's all just radical individualism. And then the problem is these misguided social systems. If we can just fix those. And so you have these radical socialists, these communists in our midst that are convinced if we can just bring that system into the United States or into Britain, it would solve all the ills of our society. The Atlantic had a pretty good piece, surprisingly. Richard kept noting that as he sent me his summary. Americans have lost sight of what fascism means. That's from The Atlantic. It talks about this Tom Cotton op-ed. He wrote an op-ed for the New York Times back in, I think it was June, where he basically said, you know, President Trump should send in the troops to the streets and restore order. And you know what happened in the New York Times? There was a complete and total meltdown in the New York Times facility because they allowed that op-ed to go through by a senator from Arkansas, merely making the point that, yeah, we should send in the National Guard so that we can restore order to the cities. And the New York Times people, all the employees there said, how did that possibly get through that article? I mean, that's fascism. That's the worst kind of authoritarianism. That's the worst kind of tyranny. Sending in the military to the streets? Well, it says here at The Atlantic, more recently, though, the Times published an op-ed of a similar vein, except this time readers had the opportunity to glimpse what actual fascism looks like. He's talking here about an op-ed also appearing in the New York Times about China's crackdown on Hong Kong and the erosion of liberty and freedom from Hong Kong. That was just October 1st. This pro-China member of Hong Kong's executive council, Regina LP or IP, I'm not sure what the name of the company is. But basically, it exposed all of these fascist measures, these fascist tactics coming from this Chinese dictatorship. And as The Atlantic points out, this time, though, no staff revolt occurred at the New York Times, even though LP's article was an elaborate, if refreshingly frank, endorsement of real fascism. Here's someone writing in the New York Times about real fascism, and everyone working there just yawns collectively. Well, that's China. I mean, that's fine. In fact, we kind of admire China. It's just Tom Cotton. He's the problem. He's the bad guy. Well, he's a dirty Republican. So we've got to protest. We've got to protest against his op-ed. It says here, the Chinese regime's, this is from The Atlantic, the regime's totalitarianism is still more evident in Xinjiang, where the sterilization of women is systematic, with the intent to decrease the Muslim population. Chinese companies have made beauty products for export with what appears to be the human hair of these women from internment camps. Chinese authorities have organized the Pair Up and Become a Family campaign, in which more than 1 million party cadres have been dispatched to live in these households, monitoring families' every move and so on. He talks about forced marriages and things of that nature. And as I say, or as he points out, no protests to speak of. Here's the conclusion. A world where a Republican senator in a democracy, even a flawed democracy, is deemed fascist and therefore beyond the bounds of respectable discussion, while actual authoritarians or worse are free to propagate their views with little public censure, is a world that is upside down. It's a world that's upside down. It's a world that Solzhenitsyn talked about in his truly prophetic speech from 1978. My father talked about it in that 2004 article on the deadly left-wing media. I went through that in a couple of recent programs as well. The kind of terrorism that devours the mind, that kills the mind, the closing of the American mind, that's the classic from the late 1980s, Alan Bloom's book. One more quote here. It says, moral clarity requires us to seek both accuracy and proportion. Anything less does a disservice to those who actually struggled, fought, and died against fascism. If Americans, even for just a moment, could look beyond Trump, they might realize that another world, one where fascism is a living, breathing thing, awaits them. Well, that's surprising to read something that's actually pretty good from The Atlantic. But I guess even a broken clock is right twice in the day. But going back to my father and this speech and what he wrote about it, he said in 1998, we're talking about thinking that makes or destroys individuals and nations. See, the thinking, the mindset that destroys our nations, saying that Donald Trump's a fascist, Tom Cotton's a fascist, even as fascism abroad is celebrated and praised. That's also brought out in that Atlantic piece. So many of these left-wing socialists, they admire the Chinese regime. Look at what we've done with the lockdowns. We're just copying China. My father said, the heart is deceitful. He's quoting Jeremiah 17:9. The heart is deceitful above all things and desperately wicked. Who can know it? He writes, this is the evil in man that Solzhenitsyn discussed. The human mind is deceitful above all things and desperately wicked. And yet in America and Britain, we usually reason that human nature is good. That diabolical philosophy is destroying our nations. Imagine what our evil minds would do with no obligations and no laws in society. Well, we get a glimpse of it every time there's a riot. That's what society is like when there's no laws, when there's no order, when there's no personal responsibility, when there's no respect for private property. We get a glimpse of it. It's a philosophy that's destroying our nations, as my father said. Imagine Well, further on, as it is, there is usually no teaching of character to control our thinking. We live in a world of fantasy and illusion. As a result, our society's falling apart. The mind of man, human nature, is desperately wicked. He says, finally, we should be building God's character by overcoming this mind, not trusting and relying on it. No nation can long endure on such a vile foundation. If you go back and study Solzhenitsyn's speech from 1978, he said that we have an obligation not just to obey the law, but to also pursue higher virtues. I mean, that's like you're reading from one of the founding fathers of the United States. And this was just a Russian poet who lost his citizenship in 1974. And then he comes over here and he gives us this truly prophetic warning. And boy, did the media turn on him. They didn't like what he said at all. Solzhenitsyn said, he even brought that up in his speech from 42 years ago. He said, hastiness and superficiality, these are the psychic diseases of the 20th century, and more than anywhere else, this is manifested in the press. In-depth analysis of a problem is anathema to the press. It's contrary to its nature. The press merely picks out sensational formulas. Such as it is, however, the press has become the greatest power within Western countries, exceeding that of the legislature, the executive, and the judiciary. Yet one would like to ask, according to what law has it been elected? And to whom is it responsible? You can get an idea of why the press despised him after this message, after this speech, after this truly prophetic warning. Solzhenitsyn said, in the communist East, a journalist is frankly appointed as a state official. But who has voted Western journalists into their positions of power? For how long a time? And with what prerogatives? Who put them in those positions? Who corrects them? You look at executives in the news today, and who can deny, as he pointed out in 1978, they've got more power than government leaders. This is why the president goes around and routinely says they're an enemy of the people. They hate America. They want to bring down the United States. That's all part of the sickness from within. I went into that at length on yesterday's show, the art of the false narrative. You can get to that at the trumpet.com website. And we told you about the cover-up. The New York Times, I think it was on Sunday or maybe yesterday, it came out and really praised the Wall Street Journal. I guess they were supposed to be printing a big story on the Hunter Biden laptop and all of these scandalous activities in the Biden family with China and Russia and Ukraine. And for whatever reason, the Wall Street Journal pulled the story. There's a tremendous amount of pressure to just blot it out. And so here comes the New York Times just applauding the Wall Street Journal, saying, hey, this is a return, the return of the media gatekeepers. I mean, we're in control of the information that the ordinary citizen receives, okay? They fancy themselves as the gatekeepers. They frame it just so, as I said yesterday. And here they are applauding. Now they're applauding Vladimir Putin, because Putin came out and said these transactions that the Biden family had with Russia, everything was above board, A-okay, nothing unlawful there, as if Putin's going to say, yeah, you know, we did do some shady dealings with the Biden family. And just 2 years ago, Putin came out and said, we didn't meddle in your election, and Donald Trump indicated that he rather agreed with him. And, I mean, the media meltdown. At that time, how could you believe Putin? He's a liar. Now they're singing a different tune at NBC because, well, this just helps us to say, hey, The Biden, all of this stuff about Biden, it's disinformation. That's the angle that we've taken. Solzhenitsyn was ahead of his time. My father said this, "We are not truly ruled by those people we vote into office. The press has the greatest power. But this is a symptom of a far deeper problem." Well, he leads into every man doing what seems right in his own eyes. And of course, that gets to, a deeper problem that goes beyond the press, beyond Democrats, beyond the radical left, beyond communism, socialism. The problem ultimately is the plague of the human heart. What Jeremiah wrote about in Jeremiah 17 and verse 9. Well, we'll have to talk about solutions at a later time because we're out of time for today's show. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Email us, td@kpcg.fm. Thank you for joining us today, and we'll see you tomorrow.